You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
We are unstoppable, a better world is possible.
We are unstoppable, a better world is possible.
We are unstoppable, a better world is possible.
On a recent Friday, a couple hundred students walked out of their classrooms. They got on buses, and they arrived at the steps of City Hall in downtown LA to try to stop greenhouse gas emissions and to save the planet.
The thought of, like, being in math class and learning about, like, vectors while, like, I could be, like, fighting to prevent imminent doom is ridiculous. Nothing else matters. Nothing else matters if not this.
That's 17-year-old Marav Price, a junior at Calabasas High School. They are one of the teens leading this protest.
This is not just an after-school activity. This is not just something that I'm doing for, like, college or to keep myself busy. This is something I do out of necessity. This is something that I do out of urgency.
That's a sentiment a lot of their classmates share as well, which is why many of these climate strikes are organized and led by people who aren't even old enough to vote. And it's no different here in Southern California. Last month, three of LA's youth climate leaders kept audio diaries for KCRW, recording as they moved from climate strike protests to their classes, to then testifying before the state legislature and planning for their futures, all with the weight of the world on their shoulders.
My name is Sim Marcel Bilal. I'm an organizer with Youth Climate Strike Los Angeles. When I was six, I used to suffer from really, really bad night terrors because I listened to Al Gore talk about global warming and things like that. So it just really stuck in my mind. I just had this image of my bedroom flooding, and then I would wake up and I'd be sweating and I'd be crying for like days on end. The same amount of anxiety and frustration I felt back then, I still have it today. The only difference is I'm bigger and I'm louder now, and I can actually speak up and call for action and defend myself.
All right. First of all, you know, I want to say thank you to everyone for making it out today. You know, striking for the climate is something that we need to be doing a lot.
Hi, everyone. I'm Paula Hoffman. I'm an organizer with Youth Climate Strike Los Angeles, and I'm just going to be talking for a quick moment about why we're here today.
I actually got involved after I just volunteered to marshal at a strike in 2019, the global climate strike in November. There aren't a lot of people doing it, and there are tons of people who are willing to show up. You just need people to host the strikes. You need people to put that information into the world, and then other people will follow suit because people do care and people do want to learn. And this generation especially is very passionate about living and having a future.
Hi, my name is Merle Price. I'm a youth climate organizer with YCSLA. So we are here to demand that banks assume basic responsibility in what their money invests in. We are here to demand bank divestment from fossil fuels and investment in renewable and sustainable energy. It is time for us to take action and to mobilize our communities and families against these banks.
Hi, I'm here with Sam.
What's up?
We're at Chase Bank in Detailer.
We're shutting down Chase Bank.
We shut them down.
So we gathered outside of Chase Bank because they are the single largest funder of fossil fuel extraction. And there were probably like 15 of us.
Skip last two periods today, but you know, I'd rather skip a couple periods than like not have a future.
And LAPD escalated in ways that nobody thought they would.
There was roughly 100 police that showed up in riot gear.
There was an exchange between me and the police officers that were basically in charge of holding us off while they apprehended the four scientists.
I deserve a future. Your children deserve a future. Your grandchildren. You are on the wrong side of history, right? Please. You are on the wrong side of this.
You know, I've been getting a lot of people praising me, I guess, for my quote-unquote bravery, so to say. I don't feel brave for doing that. I just really just spoke from the heart and anger with the response in the state in general, and I think that resonated with a lot of people, including the officers I was talking to. And many of them, you know, were on the verge of crying, or actually started crying.
Hi, it's Paola. I was just playing guitar, and then I figured I should probably check in.
I'm back home, back from my trip out of town to check out college, and now that I have officially made my enrollment, we have to go right back to work. I'm currently in my room at my desk. We're still working to get SB 1173 through as many different Senate hearings as we can. SB 1173 would require that two of the state and nation's largest public pension funds in their respective areas divest from fossil fuels.
Next Tuesday is the next one, and we have the Judiciary Committee that's meeting.
Again, I'm presenting SB 1173, which will prohibit the California Public Employees Retirement System and the California State Teachers Retirement System from investing in the 200 largest fossil fuel companies, known as the Carbon Underground 200, and require that they divest any current investments by the year 2030.
Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Paola. I'm with Youth Climate Strike Los Angeles, and we strongly support SB 1173.
Thank you.
Sim Bilal, on behalf of Youth Climate Strike Los Angeles, we strongly support SB 1173 and urge you to vote yes.
Thank you.
Our bill came out successfully of the Judicial Committee, so we are now on to the Appropriations Committee. So it feels good to, you know, celebrate a win like this. This is huge.
I wish I could feel happy about it, but I'm just so exhausted. You know, people didn't think we would be able to get the CTA, and we got the CTA, and people don't think we're going to be able to get the California Senate Retirement Committee, but we got them. But it's just after that, another committee, and onto another committee, and onto another committee, and it doesn't stop.
Good things came out today, and then, you know, I go back tomorrow to Los Angeles in preparation for Earth Day.
Hey, this is Paola. I am currently working on writing a speech. Tomorrow is Earth Day, or Earth Crisis Day, as we have been preparing for, and I haven't actually had a full speaking position at an event yet, so I'm really excited. Yeah, I'm gonna have a very long day, and then the next day I have my prom. I'm going with a bunch of friends. We're really excited. Because despite all of this, I'm somehow still a high schooler, and it's my senior prom. That's crazy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paola Hoffman. I'm an organizer with Youth Climate Strike Los Angeles. We're here today at UCLA because we are begging the UC system to care. Not to just say carbon offsets and we love the earth, but to actually do something real. Money talks. That's why corporations have to greenwash, because if they can't brainwash us, they'd lose our business. You say you want to build a better future? Then put your money where your mouth is. Yep. Thank you.
Hello, this is Sim Bilal, and today is April 22nd, so Earth Day. I definitely feel like the turnout could have been better, but it was fine. Corporations took over Earth Day, and politicians took over Earth Day and greenwashed it. I am so tired of just, you know, begging these adults to do the right thing. Like, I shouldn't have to beg you to do the right thing. You should just do it. I've been neglecting everything that's not the climate crisis or not the environmental movement. There is no point on me focusing on anything, you know, if I cannot secure a livable future for myself and my siblings and stuff like that. I feel like I've felt as an older brother, and that includes protecting them from the climate crisis. And so, I don't know, right around Earth Day, I get a little bit frustrated and a little bit less hopeful.
Because we're the people most affected by the climate crisis.
I feel really good. There's a good kind of tired after these kinds of events, because you're exhausted, but you feel like maybe there's a chance that this time things will go better. I'm really sad that
I'm not going to be in the LA area anymore, especially now I feel like I've created such a close bond. I'm going to go to Houston. I'm going to go to Rice University, and I'm going to... Well, I'm currently dedicated to study astrophysics, but sometimes I feel guilty about it because how am I going into the sciences but not the science that we need right now to save the Earth? And then I think about how depressing that is because, you know, you tell kids to chase their dreams, and I'm sitting here feeling bad because I want to do that. I also have to be realistic.
We need to demonstrate the power of what happens when the youth and intersectional movements are united, because we are the generation that is rising up to vote and rising up to make our voices heard. And if people are claiming that they are going to be representing us in office, then they need to hear us.
This story, by the way, was reported and produced by KCRW's Kaylee Wells. Special thanks to Sim Marcel Bilal, Paula Hoffman, and Marav Price for sharing their audio diaries with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on with KCRW's Greater LA, and back in the year 2020, the Burbank Unified School District made the decision to remove five books from its curriculum, pretty familiar books: Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry by Mildred D. Taylor, The K by Theodore Taylor, and Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. They removed those books because several parents, some of whom are Black, were concerned about the potential harm that they could have on the hundreds of Black students in the district. Well, shortly after, a Burbank high school student, Sungju Yoon, started a petition to protest the decision. He says he'd already read the banned books and didn't want them taken from the school's curriculum. He recently wrote an essay published in the New York Times about how the district's decision affects him and his classmates. And here he is, Sungju Yoon, reading a portion of that essay.
At the time, my position was this. I acknowledged that Black students were being marginalized in our classrooms. I was sympathetic, too. I'm all too familiar with the demeaning nature of racism. But I didn't think that it was the fault of these books or their content. I believed, and still believe, that the solution was not to remove the books, but rather to add books written by people of color and to better train teachers and to teach these books sensitively to students. As the petition attracted signatures, I spoke at several school board meetings on the issue. And I remember one meeting in particular. I'd prepared to talk about how these novels helped shape me both as a student and as a human being. I spoke briefly about how reading the story of the Logan family in Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry had moved me to tears. It pushed me to learn more about the resilience and resistance of the people upon whose backs this country was built on. I explained how these class experiences helped move me and some of my fellow students from complacent private citizens to people who today are deeply involved in the fight for social justice. There was more I could have said. How Atticus Finch's defense of Tom Robinson in To Kill a Mockingbird taught me the danger of complacency, and how the unlikely friendships of Huck and Jim in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, or Philip Enright and Timothy in The K, they taught me that love transcends any and all differences. But standing on the boardroom floor as comments from others in the meeting began, I witnessed the public forum, made up mostly of parents, administrators, and educators, devolve into tribalist dissension. The meeting quickly became a two-sided shouting match, pitting supposed freedoms against purported justice. And there was plenty of arguing, but almost no meaningful discussion on why those novels were in question, or what students would lose or gain by a ban against them. At that moment, I had a long overdue realization. How we as Americans approach restrictions on literature curriculums isn't only flawed, but also wholly reactionary. My experience at that meeting and others convinced me that the problem is not that we disagree, but how we disagree. We need to shift focus away from reflexive outrage about restrictions and bans towards actual discussions of the merits and drawbacks of these individual books. Almost a year and a half later, the Burbank book restriction is still in place, and more have been approved in schools and school districts across the country. In fact, a recent report from Pen America found that nearly 100 school districts in the country have banned around 1,600 books in the past year alone. For example, the Tennessee School Board that decided Mouse, Art Spiegelman's graphic novel about the Holocaust, couldn't be taught. Then there's the Oklahoma State Legislature's proposed law, which would give a parent of any student the power to enforce bans on books of a sexual nature. And don't forget, a Texas superintendent wanted to remove 130 books from school shelves with sexual themes. One element unites all these conflicts: a political and ideological partisanship that buys more into contemporary culture wars than into our students' actual educations. One fact often overlooked in these disputes is that both conservatives and liberals engage in book banning and removal when it suits their political goals. Burbank is a liberal stronghold where the majority of voters in the last five presidential elections cast ballots for Democrats. That district in Texas that removed the 130 books this year for, quote, pervasively vulgar content or, quote, pornography is a conservative stronghold that voted Republican in those same five elections. But many believe that's just code speak to conceal prejudice against those who identify as LGBTQ. Americans are conditioned to resist violations of our, quote, freedom at every turn, and we tend to reflexively reject any literary censorship. But we often forget that these types of book bans aren't instituting a national book burning or punishments for reading the books. Instead, they're often decisions about whether certain groups of children are emotionally or developmentally ready for certain books. And the truth is that all schools have curriculums, and that deciding what's included and what's not is a crucial responsibility that involves subjective decisions about what's best for students. And I do want to give this notion some deference. When I was 10, I found myself voraciously reading all things related to World War II. I picked up a copy of Iris Chang's 1997 book, The Rape of Nanking. Two chapters in, as the executions of innocent children my age were described in detail, I learned that the contents of the historical account were just about as discomforting as the title itself. I was terrified and upset, and I put the book down and stored it deep in my closet. Did my aversion to that book negate the severity of the war crimes that occurred on the Sino-Japanese front? Absolutely not. But did it show that I was probably too young to read it? Yes. Both principles can be true at the same time. Certain books can be important to society while being upsetting or harmful to a child. We can and ought to reject the false binary being sold to us today, because there is some value in restricting curriculum to children when those decisions are informed by a knowledge of the books and the capacities of the students. I hope that the adults who make the decisions about our schools and our educations, and those who fuel the public arguments over them, can put an end to their hyperpartisanship. I hope they help us to begin rigorous conversations about the content and the value of the books themselves. Because at that meeting, I never did get to say my piece about what those other books had done for me.
Sungju Yoon is a junior at Burbank High School. You can read the full essay on our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Coming up, LA's most famous cougar. No, this isn't TMZ. I'm talking about P22. How's the old cat doing these days? It's yours after we pause for this. It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. P22 first made his home in Griffith Park about a decade ago. And since then, the elusive cougar, or mountain lion, has captured the hearts of many an Angeleno and become an object of fascination, even social media following. He's certainly an influencer, isn't he? But the longtime bachelor has reached the ripe old age of 12, which is the normal life expectancy for a wild cougar. So how much longer can we expect him to be around? And what about all the other mountain lions in Southern California? Beth Pratt is California Director for the National Wildlife Federation, here to talk about it today. Hey, Beth.
Hi, how's it going today, Steve?
It's good. It's good. And we're going to talk about how it's going for P22. And like I mentioned, a lot of folks have grown to love him. What do you think has made him stand out so much?
You know, I think he is what a psychologist once told me, a relatable victim. what Angelino can't identify with the 405 divide impacting your dating life, right? Or,
Yes, I can tell you the 405 has affected me in many ways.
Yes, but I also think it's a little more than that. And I like to call him the Brad Pitt of the cougar world because, like Brad, he's aged well. We all love him. I think it gets at something more fundamental to get a little serious for a second. I think that LA wants a connection to wildness and loves having this holdover from the Ice Age, right? Of not just wildness, but a creature that's been with us for tens of thousands of years.
He's never mated, right? He hasn't mated with any other mountain lion, any other...
Well, I mean, since in Griffith Park, no. But who knows, when he was on his way to Griffith Park. It's unlikely, but he might have had a little fling. Who knows?
Yeah, in all seriousness, I mean, another cougar, P97, right, got hit on the 405. I mean, we talk about these freeways that they have to navigate or cross, and those freeways are always busy. How often does that happen in L.A.?
Unfortunately, all too often, and it's not just an L.A. problem, and it's not just a California problem. I mean, animals getting hit by cars is a worldwide problem on a scale that I don't think we think about too much. After getting involved in building this wildlife crossing, which we just broke ground on and which P22 absolutely not just inspired, but helped us get built to ensure a future for his kind in LA. But the moral cost of driving, I don't think is something we've reckoned with. And just in the Los Angeles area alone, the study area for the National Park Service, we've lost 26 cats in 20 years. Now, when you're talking only a population at any one time of an estimated 10 to 12, that's a lot of cats. And those are just statistics. It's a horrible death.
I mean, most male mountain lions from the Santa Monica Mountains haven't lived past two.
Two, exactly. You look at, the National Park Service research, who has showed us so much. We wouldn't know we needed a crossing if it wasn't for their research. We wouldn't know how these animals like P22 move on the landscape. These males just don't make it, whether it's roads or rat poisons or just urban living in general. And that's why connectivity is so important to ensure that these cats stay with us in the future.
What kind of timeline do we have for the 101 cross? This is the Wallace-Annenberg Wildlife Crossing, right? In Agoura Hills?
Yeah, I'm a bit dizzy. I've been working on it a decade. Some of the other partners, like the Park Service or the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy, for decades. We just broke ground. I'm still exhausted, to be honest, but exhilarated. And this crossing will be finished in 2025. So if you missed the groundbreaking party, the ribbon-cutting party is... will happen then, but we'll have some celebrations in between, including the 7th annual P22 Day Festival this year on October 22nd, the official P22 Day, and in 2022. You can't get, a better year for P22.
Why P22? Why do we call them P22?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And so the National Park Service, it is the numeric rating they give them in order of tagging them in their study. So P stands for puma, which is one of the names for mountain lions. It's a scientific name. There's a lot of names for mountain lions. That's why it gets confusing. Mountain lion, panther, cougar, all the same animal. And 22 means he was the 22nd cat tagged in the study. And obviously they're up to, I think, 104 now.
Is it too late for him to find a mate at age 12?
I never say never with wildlife. Us scientists thinks we have it all figured out, but this is why I love working in wildlife. They do things that astound us. And that P22 made it to Griffith Park, that he's kind of remained there in a very small habitat. It's the smallest habitat ever recorded by science for a male mountain lion. Is astounding itself. So it is very unlikely a female. They tend not to journey as far as males to disperse. So it's very unlikely a female would make it.
I hate to ask this question, but what happens when he goes? Is there a plan in place? Will we have A memorial? What goes on when P22 goes?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of us are you know, going to be, quite frankly, in mourning. He's been a cat that has inspired us, that we is beloved. And yes, of course, anybody who knows me, you know, we will not go without. For him, it will be a celebration of life. You know, it'll be an L.A. style party to celebrate that cat. But hopefully it still will be a few years off.
Let's hope. Yeah. Beth Pratt, California Director for the National Wildlife Federation. Beth, as always, thanks.
Thank you for having me. Always good to talk P22 with you.
That's going to do it for us today. Next week, now that there's opposition, will Governor Newsom's CARE Court bill make it in Sacramento? That's yours. We're online always at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, won't you? Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Ludman, Juliana Mayo, Kaylee Wells, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl. All help make the show happen tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Have a great night.